Today is Friday. It's January 8th, 2016. Happy New Year. This is John Williams. We are the Mincing Rascals. Eric Zorn from the Chicago Tribune joins us for our weekly podcast. Hi, Eric.
Hey, John.
Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio is here.
Hello, John Williams.
Kristen McQuarrie normally joins us, the editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune. She can't be with us today. Mr. Zorn does a column in the Chicago Tribune. Steve Bertrand hosts shows and does news at WGN Radio. So we start this week with President Obama's speech and town hall meeting on guns. He made 4 points this week, including the town hall meeting, that we should make gun registration more comprehensive, that we should engage more federal agents on gun trafficking, that we should spend more money on mental illness and its relationship to people killing themselves with guns, and we should find technological solutions to the problem. And he cried a lot. The takeaway for me on this was I was happy to see the president address the mental health issue as much as he did. That for all the gun deaths we have in this country, 2 out of 3 of them are self-inflicted. That's a staggering number. It's a realization that maybe was in the background but not in the forefront, and I'm glad the president addressed that. And I was really sorry to see so many people on the right mock the president's tears. Donald Trump did not, but other candidates did, and Lord knows Fox News made a lot of fun of the fact that the president cried. They called those tears insincere. Eric Zorn, what was your takeaway from the president's addressing the country this week?
Well, my takeaway is that he is suggesting some rather incremental steps that don't seem to me to threaten the basic fundamental right people have to have guns to protect themselves and to go hunting. And yet there is such a strong sentiment in this country that gun rights are always in peril, and that any sort of restriction or clamping down or even extra enforcement of the gun laws that we have gets the paranoid people just completely bent out of shape.
Gun stocks went up this week. Gun stocks, bad week for the Dow, bad week for the markets, good week for gun stocks.
But it might be a strong sentiment, Eric, but it's not a widely shared sentiment. And that's what is amazing to me about all of this, right? I mean, Ball State did a survey, I think it was last week. In Indiana, 63 or 68% of the people favor closing this gun show loophole. A Quinnipiac poll nationwide has the number closer to 80 to 90%. I mean, 90% of us, we don't agree that tomorrow's going to be Saturday.
Right. It's the passion gap, though. It's the fact that the people who are motivated by this issue, they vote and they donate. And so you're right. I mean, it is preposterous that such a suffocating majority of American people want greater background checks. They're pretty much okay with these kinds of things that the president is proposing, but politically they just seem to be untenable.
The guy who disappointed me the most last week was House Speaker Paul Ryan, because I kind of had hopes that he would, and you know, he's got pressures of his own clearly, but I had hopes that he would be a different sort of leader there, and he went right away with, you know, Obama going after your guns and
They're
all
gonna
that.
They're going to take your guns. That was Ted Cruz's thing,
well,
too.
Well, no, I expect it from Ted Cruz, but I didn't expect it quite as strong as it came from Speaker Ryan.
Yeah, Ted Cruz's ads on this were just reprehensible. I mean, I my dislike for him grows all the time, but the idea that Obama or anybody on the left is going to come into your house and take your guns.
They're going to take your guns.
And the idea that if we have any sort of limitation on the number or the kind of guns that you can buy, or that if we register them so we know where they are, that this is just one little step on the way to jackbooted thugs coming into everybody's house and taking the guns away. I mean, that is just crazy. And if you have that kind of crazy sentiment guiding your politics, you're never going to get anything done. And so when I see this, let's have a conversation about guns, I watch it, but I'm filled with just despair and resignation over the fact that we'll ever get anything done.
Chris Christie was asked on MSNBC, you know, Governor, what do you think of these people who are saying that the government's going to go get your guns? They're not going to do that. And he said, yeah, they are. Essentially, I don't want to misquote him, but essentially he said, yeah, no, I think that's true. Well, you know, so even he was feeding that.
Well, I understand the notion that they're going to get your guns. They're going to get your 10th gun, or they're going to get your 1,000th round of ammunition, or they're going to get your gun that looks like a semi-automatic but isn't. I mean, there is, let's not kid ourselves here, an effort to curtail people's access to guns. And
that's true, but John, curtailing someone's access to guns, we already curtail their access to guns. You can't buy guns if you're under a certain age. You can't buy a machine gun without going through a bunch of hoops. You can't buy any kind of automatic
weapon. Right, but here's the problem with that,
Eric. It is curtailed.
But the idea, I mean, let's just flesh this out a little bit. The bad guys aren't going to adhere to any more restrictive laws any more than they are now. So we also need to address the fact that people who don't like the president's stance on this don't like it because they're the good people play by the rules. How does that help or defend them?
It's the same strategy. We should use the same strategy that we use to control the flow of Sudafed. I mean, it's crazy. You can't buy Sudafed in this country without having to give them your ID and register, and they limit the amount of Sudafed you can buy because the active ingredient in Sudafedrine can be cooked into methamphetamine. We realize that, and so that means every law-abiding user of Sudafed has to suffer a little bit because of these people who take their Sudafed and turn it into meth. I don't see why law-abiding people who want to buy guns can't suffer a little bit in order to control the incredible flow of firearms in this country. I think people should be able to own guns. I really do. I think that homeowners should be able to have them.
And I think the president believes that too. You know, they say his words are hollow, but don't you believe that the president knows he has to stand by the Second Amendment, at least to some degree?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure that the Second Amendment – I mean, I know the Supreme Court has said that it protects an individual right. I read the part about the well-regulated militia. I'm not sure exactly what it means, and I'm not sure that the founders, if they saw the kind of firepower that we have now, would write it the same way. But I think he's okay with the idea. I mean, I really don't think that, you know, that your grandma living somewhere or your average homeowner who lives out in the country or even in the city who wants a pistol in his nightstand because he feels threatened. I think that person should be able to have it. I do.
What did you think, Steve?
I think the other thing that really bothered me was the way this this argument is constructed. You know, again, I'll go back to the poll. Let's say the Quinnipiac poll. Let's say 90% of the people, let's say 75% of the people favor closing this gun show loophole. When confronted with the question, the opponents of the president aren't arguing the merits of closing the gun show loophole. They're arguing about executive order and that he doesn't have the power to do that. And I just wish that reporters questioning those people would turn it again and say, okay, fine, executive order aside, do you think the gun show loophole should be closed? And I think opponents haven't been forced to answer that. They've been able to evade the question by instead arguing over executive orders. Because I think, you know, if you've got 90% of the people who like this idea, it's hard to say that you think it's a bad idea.
I understand why the right feels that this might not be all that effectual, right? That maybe limiting internet sales or gun show sales, you know, that it'd be more difficult for you to register those guns. If you're going to sell it to your brother-in-law in the living room, you actually have to do some sort of background check. I understand how they think that would be cumbersome.
It's cumbersome, John, but if it helps control the flow of guns to bad, I think we all can agree that we don't want bad people to have guns.
But if I sell my brother-in-law my car, right, there's some cumbersomeness with that. I've got to transfer the title.
The Second Amendment does not protect your right to own a car. I mean, there's something different. Guns are different than everything else. Sudafed, cars, air. It's like that, I'm telling you. And listen, I'm on your side, guys. Here's what bothers me the most about this. If both sides at least say that we need to do some sort of compromise, I don't know how much more compromising the left can do on this issue. We have a virtually unlimited access to guns in this country. We have as many as we do human beings. And so it seems to me like the only place to step is a little more towards the center, is some sort of conciliation on this issue. And the right won't give that much, even if gun show registration isn't going to solve the problem. I wish they'd throw them a bone and just say, all right, it's not going to be a big deal, but we get your point. Will this make you happy? It would shut us up for years if they would just show us that much. And that doesn't happen. And then they swing it around to Chicago. I want your guys' reaction to that. There was a lot of time spent this week after the president's speech saying, well, boy, he sure didn't come down on Chicago. He didn't fix it in Chicago. Why isn't he referencing how bad it is in Chicago? He mentioned it, but...
He mentioned Chicago in his... I don't know if he
mentioned
did in his
it, but right. But where was the condemnation or where was the acknowledgement that it was tough to get a gun in Chicago and yet many people saw it as the murder capital of the country?
Because it's really super easy to get a gun in Indiana.
And And people bring them up. And one of the points that he made last night in talking about gun violence in Chicago was that you can go down to gun shows in Indianapolis or Fort Wayne or Lafayette or wherever they have them, and you can load up duffel bags full of guns and bring them up and sell them out of the back of your car without too much trouble.
You probably know this better than me, Eric, but isn't the statistic 60% of the guns confiscated in Chicago come from Indiana?
I don't remember that number. But
I read that somewhere.
Yeah, it's certainly possible.
60% of the Republicans confiscated in Chicago come from Indiana.
The Republicans confiscated?
That was my funny little thing I just said there.
We'll get it in a minute.
Yes. Kristen, can we add a rim shot to that in post-production?
All right, let's leave this topic for a moment.
I think we're so close to solving it, too.
No, but that's it.
Okay, we'll move on.
It is frustrating, isn't it? I think for people listening to us who agree with us, and certainly those who don't, because we're just articulating the problem that is no closer to a solution than it was 10 years ago or will be in 10 years. And that's the sad part about this. Winter hats on female reporters at Channel 32. Bob Feeder had a piece this week. He got the email from the executive producer of Good Day Chicago, and he said that the women on Channel 32 would look prettier if they weren't wearing hats when they were reporting outside. The general manager has since described it more as an email problem than a sexism problem.
Yeah, right.
But
well, it is for him.
I know. I think, God, he's thinking, wow, I got two problems now. A, I have the hat female problem, and B, I have the email problem. And it sounded more like he was concerned about the latter. What a dope. That one's hard to reconcile, isn't it? And by the way, people on TV are on TV because they're pretty. And the prettier you are, the better it is. So I understand the temptation to go down that road. But you can't say that.
They pay a lot of attention to how they look when they're standing outside for no good reason on cold nights. And so it isn't unreasonable to think that you would want your reporters to look their best when they're out there. I would say that if it's too cold to be out without a hat, then you shouldn't be outside. You should be inside doing your stand-up. But
no, you got to be outside.
Well,
you got to be outside. That way we know you're there. You're on the scene. We can see your breath. I'm here at the scene of the accident.
That happened 12 hours ago.
Yeah, that just kills me when they're like, well, he's live in Lake County. And the guy's standing in front of the courthouse. It's been closed for 6 hours.
There's some guy buying a taco behind him or something.
It's just like the Weather Channel reporting. It's dangerous. Don't come out here. I'm standing in the surf of Hurricane X.
I will say, though, that, you know, watching, and I'm at a health club most mornings when they've got all the TVs on and no sound, and so you and I'm not going to pick out anyone in particular because frankly I don't even know who I'm talking about, but we have moved back towards a sex 'em up, I think, sort
quite.
Of weather girl, traffic girl sort of look. I think we moved away from it maybe in the early 2000s, late 90s, but I'm telling you, I think we're going back toward it.
Well, does anybody watch The Five on Fox? Holy cow. Those women are beautiful, and they're glammed up, and they wear high heels, and they sit at the console so that you can see their legs. And
that was going to be my recommendation this week. No, I haven't seen that, John.
Yeah, and that's a network show, but I think it does trickle down to the local level. I don't even have a problem with that. I mean, why not hire the prettier people if they can do the job? It's a visual medium.
Well, how would we react around the table here to this memo if it had not specified that the women reporters? I guess
right,
there
because
were only,
men were exempt from this.
Or they just weren't mentioned. Apparently there are no men on this reporting team or something like that. Feeder had something like that in his blog. But yeah, to me, the sexism angle jumped out. If it had just been an edict like reporters don't wear hats when you're outside, I don't think we would have reacted to it quite as strongly. But I mean, I can sort of see it as a because it's such a visual. If you're going to be outside, and take your hat off, and especially if it's only for like 40 seconds of a stand up, take your hat off because we hired you.
Yeah, but Eric, why do you see it? But I can see that you don't have to have a hat on to survive it. But the instruction is clearly for the sex appeal of it or the glamour of it.
Yeah, and the fact that it was directed at women and not at both genders, I think, makes it really different.
Besides, what's lost on this is that there's nothing prettier Careful, John.
It's too late, John. Oh, it's too late.
Well, there's nothing prettier than a nice young lady with a cute hat. I'm telling you, I know a little bit about this.
Oh, my goodness.
I live in Minnesota. I watch Minnesota TV, and the female reporters here report outside, and they wear really cool hats that kind of trend a little bit. In fact, one of them got a network job, and everybody knew she was the girl with the fun hats. She was a reporter, and she was outside all the time. There's some charm to winter hats.
Right, so you're saying you can wear a nice hat and still look professional and
adorable or attractive or whatever it is that the look is you're going for. They just missed that memo.
I hope we're segueing now to Marco Rubio's boots.
Yeah, he was upset that there was a lot of attention spent on those, right, Steve?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know too much about it. I just saw a picture of it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that concludes our discussion of Marco Rubio.
Well, they were kind
of
high heels, right? There was a heel on them.
He's not a tall man, so maybe.
Hey, what about Ted Cruz's citizenship then, fellas?
Oh, I'm worried about the senator.
He should be the president of the United States by virtue of his citizenship. If the people want to elect him, nobody has a problem with that. And Trump is coyly saying, well, I don't have a problem with it, but the Democrats will. And we don't want to see this country tied up for 2 years in some sort of litigation over a candidate or a sitting president's residency.
What was really amusing to me about this was that John McCain,
yes,
a second to the objection. Now, John McCain was not born in the United States. He was born in Panama.
He
was born in the, it was when I saw a military, and he said, well, the difference is that he was born on a U.S. military installation, which is technically U.S. soil, I guess.
But American.
But all that means is that McCain really hates Ted Cruz.
Yes, I think this is what, yes, yeah, he does. He's called him a wacko bird, and he is a wacko bird, let me just give a little background here. Cruz was born in Calgary in 1970 to a mother who was born in Delaware, U.S. citizen by birth. And his father was at the time a legal resident of the United States from Cuba. I think he's since become a citizen, but he was not a citizen. It's immaterial. The fact that he was born to an American parent anywhere at the time of his American citizen, he was an American citizen by birth, which is the only rational definition of the term natural born citizen, which is what the Constitution requires.
Says you. No. I mean, this has not had a Supreme Court test.
It is, but there's no court precedent that says anything other than that. There have been lower court decisions and lower opinions that have come out talking about this, but there's no contrary opinion. No one has ever said no. And of course, it doesn't come up. How often does
but
it ever come up?
If you're born to an American, you're an American.
Right.
What's the next question?
Yeah, well, the next question, and if you want to get into the weeds, the reason that the Obama birthers thought they had a gotcha card is that when Dunham, what was her name, her first name, his mother. When Obama's mother gave birth to Barack, she was like 19 or 18 still. She was very young. And she had not been a resident. There was some requirement that you had to be like – oh, you had to live in the United States. You had to be a citizen. You had to live in the United States for at least 5 years after age 14 to qualify to give birth to a citizen. It was
very
strange law at the time. And Dunham, right? And it was a very strange law, and they had her under it by about 3 months. So if she had been in Kenya, which she wasn't, but if she had been and given birth to him, technically he would not have been a citizen because she was so young. That was the whole – that was the slim thread.
Eric, you're pretty good at this. Yeah, whose side are you on?
No, I'm saying that's the slim thread that they hang
slim
this on.
Slim thread? I'm convinced now. Are you kidding me? Let's get rid of him.
Younger Americans are less American?
Well, yeah. It had to do with the fact they didn't want people who had just been – who were born in the U.S. and then had moved away for a long time.
All right. So segue to Cruz then.
Well, Cruz clearly qualifies. There's absolutely no question about it. This is not a serious issue. The Supreme Court would
– It's not even a concern. There's no – do you hear – look, Democrats aren't going to vote for Cruz anyway, and Republicans don't care that Cruz has this citizenship issue. Tell me where's the groundswell of people who are worried about Cruz's legitimacy? I don't see it. I don't hear it. Do you?
No, but that's because it's only now being created.
I think it's a sign
that my point.
It's stupid. We need to use the word stupid more often, and that's what this is.
For those of you who are missing the voice of Kristen McQuarrie, she and I talk about this in the paper today. We did a two-person column, a dialogue column and we touch on this issue, and we talked about how the fact that this is not truly an issue, and it is stupid, and it may be showing is that Trump is getting a little bit scared about what's going on in Iowa. If Trump loses Iowa, he shows weakness among the conservative, the hardcore conservative evangelical base that he's going to need going forward.
Well, he's poised to lose.
He's poised to lose. He's 4 points behind in the polling average or something like that. He's poised to lose there. He's going to probably win New Hampshire, which is like 9 days after. And then there's a couple of minor events, Nevada and
South Carolina.
South Carolina
is
somewhat big, yeah. But then Super Tuesday comes. And so what this is all about is a jockeying for position in February, because a lot's going to happen on March 1st when we find out, you know, who's going to be the candidate on the insider candidate, the Chris Christie, the John Kasich, the Jeb Bush, the more mainstream. Rubio is arguably in that category. Which one of those guys is going to be the one to take on Cruz or Trump, the one who comes out ahead on the other side? I think that Cruz is afraid that Trump is afraid that if he loses to Cruz in Iowa, this weakens him for South Carolina. And if he goes in if he does poorly in South Carolina and Iowa going into Super Tuesday, he's going to be at a disadvantage. So
I hope that, you know, I always hope that his collapse would be something dramatic, and it may in fact be what I've said, what I've more championed of late, and that is it'll be gravity. It'll just be too much Trump, and you know, as the other ones fall off, those voters will go to somebody else. Trump is maxed out. He's always maxed out, and it'll be just a slow fall.
I watched him like before Obama's gun town hall. I watched his speech in Vermont last night. It was televised live from Burlington. I can see what his appeal is to that audience, because he is so sure of himself. He is so sure of how great the country is going to be. He's got this line about we're going to be succeeding so much you're going to get bored of succeeding. I am smart. The current people are dumb. The deal with Iran is stupid. I'm going to fix that. I'm going to fix health care. He doesn't give any specifics, but he speaks so confidently that if you can close your eyes and click your heels together three times and believe it, you can say, wow, this country would be just great under this guy. And I can see that. I can see why that's appealing to certain voters. I really can.
And, you know, at that Burlington, and I'm thinking of when he turned on the pool cameraman, I think, last week and said, I'd fire his ass, you know, because he won't show the crowd. And then at this Burlington event where there are a number of protesters or people, hecklers, mm-hmm. and, you know, he stops and he's not like a conventional candidate would be. It's okay. He's speaking. It's okay. We'll wait him out. You know, Trump is like, get him out of there and keep his coat. Don't give his coat. It's 10 below outside. We'll ship his coat later. Of course, it was 30 outside. It wasn't 10 below. But, you know, he just has a completely different in-your-face approach to it that they love.
Yeah, yeah.
Is Rahm Emanuel going to run after this term? He's not going to, right? Rahm Emanuel is probably in
We got a long time to go before the next election. He was just reelected last year, and he is not going to resign. One of the things I've been trying to remind people is, do you remember when they tried to fire him at the White House when he was working for Clinton, and he wouldn't leave until Bill Clinton himself fired him? And so, I mean, I think some you know, factotum came in and said, Rahm, clear out your desk. They want you gone. And he wouldn't do it. And Clinton didn't want to come in and fire him. So he stuck around. And so he ended up getting some more traction and keeping his job. He is not a quitter. He is not going to go, oh, dear, The Nation magazine is calling for my resignation. I'm going to leave. That is not Rahm Emanuel. He thinks he has such incredible self-confidence that he's not going to be derailed. And I'm not so sure that's a terrible thing, because I'm not sure what would happen. John Cass's column this morning talks a little bit about what the succession might look like. Who is going to be the next mayor?
He had a half a dozen candidates he liked for a variety of reasons.
I don't know if John liked any of them, but he certainly floated them, yeah. Tony Preckwinkle and Alderman Wagaspak.
It would have to be an alderman, right, short of
an
election?
It would You know, I don't know who would have to be. I mean, short of an election, yes. I think the city council has to pick an alderman to take a spot until the special election. I don't think they could say, you know, hey, Tony Preckwinkle, you come in.
Come on over.
I don't think they could do that. But there is that. There is the question.
Isn't she the most competent government administrator in Chicago? Who's more sober, sane, intelligent, respected, better? Who's better than Tony Preckwinkle?
Well, the bar is not real high there, John.
I was just going to say that. Come on, that silence is killing me. At least give me that.
No,
right?
I happen to think more highly of – I wish Kristen were here because she doesn't think as highly of Toni Preckwinkle. They're really mad at her for putting that sales tax back. You know, she ran on getting rid of the Cook County sales tax hike, excuse me, and then she has to raise it back to where it was.
Well, that's a policy issue. At least intelligent people can come to different conclusions. I've always thought she was bright. She was reasonable. She was the two big S's I want, sane and sober. I mean, she just seems to me to be, you know, if I disagree with her on the on a tax issue, I don't see her as an egomaniac.
Well, and she's not venal either. She's not someone, you don't feel like she's lining her pockets or trying to.
Stuff like that.
She's not trying to boost her job as a income tax lawyer or a real estate tax lawyer. She's not trying to play the angles.
But she is. This is a power play, right? With the state's attorney's race.
Absolutely, it is. She does not want Anita Alvarez there. The chess moves going on within Cook County and Chicago are really interesting, and the state too. By the way, we haven't really touched on this. I don't know if we have time for it, but you know, Governor Rauner and Mayor Emanuel have been really unloading on each other verbally about what's going on. And the Chicago Public Schools, we are really reaching that moment where it's going to go over the waterfall. I mean, they have.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean the financial crisis is really kicking in. The schools badly need money, and Governor Rauner says, "I am not going to help you out if you don't go along with my union busting." He didn't use those words, but that's
he didn't
use some of them.
But you know, these structural reforms that he wants, quote unquote, that if Emanuel doesn't go along with helping him get those, that he's not going to help bail out.
Like in this procedurally? Whose attitude do you think is better?
Well, I am not a fan of Rauner. I think that Rauner is an ideologue who bought himself the governor's office, and he wants to change things. He's got this vision of the way that he thinks the state should be, and he's not a good politician. He doesn't realize that you don't do these things all at once. That you need to. He needs to get in there and negotiate a leaner, meaner budget. He needs to take a little bit at a time. He kind of went for everything at first, and then he's been cutting back and cutting back. But I still think that he needs to sit down and negotiate a budget with the state, with the General Assembly, and forget about all these other auxiliary things. Figure out what's coming in, what's going out.
The problem if he does that now, it's a capitulation, isn't it?
Because he set it up that way.
It's his own failure.
I mean, it's his own. He doesn't know how to play the game the way and it is a game, and to say that doesn't mean that it's a
wrong,
terrible
right.
thing. You're wrong. It's like, politics is the art of compromise, really. I mean, that you have to give and you get, and you have to realize what your power is. He's a governor that has super minorities in both chambers of the General Assembly. You can't come in and act like you own the place when you've
got
that.
Do you think there's a lesson to be learned there for a Carly Fiorina or a Donald Trump? People who speak in absolutes and say, I'm from the business sector, I know how to do it, but being the CEO of a business is different than being CEO of a governmental body. And even if Trump were right, or if we all agreed that his vision was correct, it doesn't mean that you're able to exact those changes.
Oh, exactly. I mean, it's certainly what Obama found. It's what every president finds.
When you
get elected, you've got all these promises, these ideas, and you realize you're running into a Senate that has a filibuster power, and you're running into a Congress that each congressman is answering to these constituencies. It does not run like a business, and you don't want politics to run like a business. You don't want government to run like a business.
Did I see that the House sent again or approved again a vote to repeal Obamacare? This
no kidding.
And this one,
really?
I thought I was in my Wayback Machine.
Yeah, I thought they were done. I know they've done it like 40 times.
Right, but
I,
this one got to the president's desk because
did he sign it?
No, he didn't sign it. But they got it through by use of a budget reconciliation, which is one of the tricks they used to rail against.
Hey, look
the
over there, Mr. President. Sign this, quick.
Yeah, can I have your autograph? Yeah.
Here's my recommendation for the week. Have you guys seen the Leonardo DiCaprio movie, The Revenant?
No.
Maybe you haven't, because I don't know if it's actually... Yeah, it's in theaters now,
it's
right?
2.5 stars, Michael Phillips. I'm serious.
Are you serious? I missed that.
I'm looking at the paper, yeah.
Are you kidding? He gives it 2.5 stars. Well, then, there's my recommendation. Read that, because I saw the movie, and I don't think I've seen a more beautiful film in a long time. They talk about the bear scene, where he wrestles with a bear. It almost kills him. The rest of the movie, he's dealing with those injuries. It is remarkable. It's not as gruesome as maybe you heard, and it's part of the story. It's integral, and it's fascinating.
The trailer looks exhausting to me.
It's a long movie. And, you know, there's a lot of scenes where there's no dialogue because it's them traipsing through the woods and making fires and fighting. And, you know, when Leo DiCaprio is the only person on the screen, there's no reason for dialogue. So it's a study. It's a study, Steve. But, wow, good movie. I'm recommending that. I'm also recommending American Idol's last season. I've been watching the episodes of late where they are looking for the candidates, the kids that go to Hollywood, the contestants. And I've been sitting there crying because the kids are so sweet. The stories are so well told. And there is a girl from Geneva named Kayla Michelson, who's this sweet, quirky, blonde-haired gal who has a really neat voice. And I'm a fan. So there's two recommendations. Who wants to go next?
I'll go next. I have a recommendation that was something that you would turn me on to, John, which is a podcast called Anytime Minutes.
Oh, yeah.
And it's hosted by a kid named Griffin Filipich.
That's my son.
And his partner, Tony Wagner.
You don't have to say this, Eric.
No, I don't have to say it, but I have to say this, that you recommended the episode on Love Actually.
Right.
And my family we had never all seen it together. I mean, the kids had all seen it, but my wife and I hadn't seen it. We all watched it together before Christmas, and then on New Year's Eve, we were driving somewhere, and we put on this podcast. We're all of us in the car, and in which Griffin and Tony analyze scene by scene this movie, and they are hilarious. We were laughing out loud the whole trip. It is really, really good. They've got great chemistry, the two hosts. And
I wish you had invited me over, because my family watches Love Actually every year, Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And finally this year they revolted. So this is the first year
you've got to listen
that
to
I haven't seen
just,
it.
Just listen to this episode and tell me you're not hooked. It's a fun. It's a nice podcast.
So. I've seen the movie a lot, and one of the things they pointed out to me in the movie, and I thought, yeah, that is kind of ridiculous, because some of the scenes I like and some of the storylines I like, they didn't. And the scene where the boss is toying with having an affair with his secretary, one of them said, wait, she shows up at the Christmas office party wearing, it's not a costume party, devil horns. Could we be any more obvious here? And I thought, okay, maybe that was a weak, that storyline wasn't as strong as I thought it was. But thank you for that, Eric. And yeah, I'll second that motion. How about you, Steve Bertrand?
I have watched, and I hope I didn't recommend this before, The River. I think it was a BBC show, and it's on Netflix now, and it's only six 1-hour episodes. Stellan Skarsgård plays this detective in London, and in the opening episode, we see him start to chase down this car. He's obviously obsessed with finding this particular criminal. It turns out this criminal killed his partner. And I'm not big into detective shows or all of that. There's so much more to it. There's such a great mood to it. Because the thing about River, this character, is he hallucinates, or he talks to people who are in his life. They show up to him next to him in a very real way. And he has conversations with them. And everyone else, they see a man who's talking to himself. And it's not done for humor. It's not done for over effect. It's just a dramatic show. It's just a wonderful show, and it's only 6 hours.
Six episodes, and let me ask you this: does it come to a resolution?
It does.
It does. That drives me nuts when the show, like when it's like Lost or something, mm-hmm. and you go, "What?" Or Twin Peaks.
It reminds me. I don't know if you watched Broadchurch, the BBC version, a couple
yep.
years ago.
Yep. Sure.
Okay, and that was very good. That was more melodramatic than this is. This is a much better made episodic series.
And six episodes I can get my mind around sometimes.
Right, exactly.
Like, it's only three seasons of 13
Well, let's
episodes
next each. Week include, let's all think about and just follow the news this week and comment next week then.
Follow the news, oh man.
On Making a Murderer. On Making a Murderer. I talked to Senator Johnson, my favorite Republican senator from Wisconsin, Ron Johnson, about this yesterday, and I said, have you watched that? And he said, no, but wherever I go in Wisconsin, people are talking to me about it. And I said, well, you really should watch it. And he goes, no, I'm just going to let the courts decide this issue. And I said, if you need to find 11 hours and watch this. And he started laughing at me like a U.S. senator has 11 hours. And I said, you think that I'm just recommending the show the way Steve Bertrand did because we love these shows and we're all fans of them and we're advocating for our shows. I said, you need to know what people are saying and thinking about justice in America right now. I don't care what conclusions you draw. Watch the show because this is where we think justice is parked for the poor or for whomever in this country. And it's tragic. It's fascinating. So
I will say that I've read some things about this. I have not seen a minute of this series, and I should.
Is you need to find 11 hours.
11 hours.
I probably do. But that there is a sentiment that these filmmakers left out some pretty key things that suggest that Avery is actually guilty. So it just – I mean, I just watch it with a grain of salt.
Well, those aren't mutually exclusive concepts. You know, he may be guilty, but the cops are corrupt, or the prosecutors are corrupt. They were in the first case because he was innocent. But in the second case, maybe both are true. Okay, so that's it for this week. We'll pick it up here next week. These are the Mincing Rascals. Eric Zorn, you can read him online at chicagotribune.com/Zorn. He's in the print edition of that, too, you know. Steve Bertrand does, well, what's the litany of things you're involved in, Steve?
Host the Business Lunch on WGN and follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand and, you know, other things.
Are you still at Steve Bertrand on Books?
I am, yes.
And Steve Bertrand Travel, if you're interested in traveling?
Take a group to Europe. I can help you with that.
And Krista McQuarrie normally joins us. You read her editorials in the Chicago Tribune. By the way, that other podcast Eric referred to is called Anytime Minutes. This is John Williams. Thank you, Kristen Decker. Welcome back. Bob Ferguson, too, our engineer. We are the Mincing Rascals.